Everyone wants to be the best world builder that they can be. Now, with these simple tips, you can be too. Hello and welcome, everybody, to the Crit Academy. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
And I'm your co-host, Ian.
We hope to inspire you with creative content that you can bring with you on your next adventure.
All right. I am super excited for today's main topic. The website CBR put out an amazing 10 Dungeons & Dragons world-building tips. We're going to talk a little bit about it, and we're going to add our own little two copper to the topic. So if you've wanted to know how to bring your content to life, your world to life, make it feel fresh and entertaining to everyone involved, then you're at the right episode. We want to thank our pal Garwin, our Emerald patron, for joining us again, sitting in for Brandon, who is in fact not here today because it's a past holiday and he had things to do. So
yeah,
should we just dive right into it?
Dive right in.
So now, these are not in any particular order, so one isn't necessarily better than 10. They're all great tips. The very first tip that they give us is diversity of location. Holy crap, I cannot agree with this more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like, if you only have a single location that's there's no diversity anywhere, it will get stale no matter how good you make everything in there. Like, you don't even have to change the scene or all that much. Even if you're in a city that doesn't have a lot of diversity, If you make diverse enough characters, it can function.
Yep.
But that can also be more difficult than simply adding different streets with different flavor to them.
Absolutely.
Which will go a long way.
And one example that's actually given here for locations of diversity is like the general economic livelihood of sections, like such as like the upscale wealthy section of town and the poor sons of town.
Absolutely. And that's a really great example because let's say some adventures do take place entirely in the city. Doesn't mean you can't be diverse, right? Nope. And those are good examples. We are doing, we've been running through, Ravnica, which is one of the most diverse cities that you can think of because it's literally an entire planet or plane, yeah. Technically.
Yeah.
And so
Ravnica kind of cheats.
Yeah, they do. The other thing, so I don't know about anybody else, but a lot of my old school games dealt with just delving into dungeons and fighting stuff in forests and stuff in mountains, and that was pretty much it. And that wasn't nearly as unique as traveling to a different plane of existence. Right now in our plane shifters, we went from Forgotten Realms to Ravnica and, you know, delving into, the elemental plane of fire or going into, I think in, what was the giant one we did? The Storm King's Thunder?
Yeah.
That took us into high into mountains. It took us into frozen tundras. It took us deep underwater into like an Atlantean type thing. And those were very, very interesting.
Or caves with magma in them.
Yes. And that just made the game more engaging and fun than just constantly running through a typical dungeon and through the forest.
It definitely sounds like it would. The one thing people often make a mistake is that they think that in order to properly add flair, they have to go into the different planes, which you don't really need to. Like, just look at our world right now. It's quite simple. You go outside now, and then look at how people live in a desert.
Yeah. So, it's funny you mentioned that. So, in our Extraordinary Expeditions that just got funded, our Kickstarter, the 9th level adventure takes place in a desert, and I focused a lot on the description on how the world is different from the other places, from having, like, sand sleds, right, to get around.
Yeah.
And that's part of the diversity of a good diverse location is the way of everyday life of the creatures in that area. So was there anything else you think that really needs to be included when you're diversifying your locations?
I think we can hit the nail on the head and we have 10 more tips to go.
Fair enough. But because I never shut up, I got one more line to say. Diverse locations doesn't mean long travel. That's something that can easily get passed up. You can have one adventure that takes place in a forest, another one that takes place in a dreary, you know, dungeon temple underground, another one that takes place in a swamp, the top of a mountain, all that in a small area.
I mean, shoot, one great example of that was over the weekend, I finally sat down and watched Arcane, and technically the entire show takes place in one city, but there's the upper city, which is like where the wealthy live and is very well to do, and which you'd expect from like a high fantasy magic punk area, whereas there was the lower city, which is very run down.
Across
slums.
The river.
Yeah.
I've got to watch that. That sounds really good.
They do story pretty well.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He's like, they did it surprisingly well, so I'll have to check it out.
It's a show based off of League of Legends. My expectations were not high. And then just because most video game based shows aren't really that great, but this one, this is good.
I think Castlevania did really good. All right, so we're getting off topic. Diversity of locations is definitely the number one tip today. Number two is, I would say it kind of ties into it, but establish world flavor. Now,
that one's good.
What that means is the tone of the world you're setting in. You know, even if the campaign, you know, travels across the globe, there should be a constant theme or tone that kind of goes with it. A really great example of this is the animation Avatar Last Airbender. That has a tone that follows it no matter where you go. The war that's going on with the Fire Nation is a tone of, is the world flavor's tone and setting theme. And no matter where they go, even when they're having fun, you know, sliding on, you know, freaking seals or whatever down snowplow, that's still something that's constantly hanging in the air. What do you think, Garwin?
Well, it's definitely something that's really necessary to keep in mind, but something that the DM sometimes fail is to keep the overall flavor of the world a little flexible.
For
example, I'm running on a Grim Hollow in the game on every other weekend on usually on this day with two newbies and one veteran of D&D. And I started the Grim Hollow session out. You know, it's going to be horror-filled, going to be like all thriller and whatnot. And then two or three sessions in, I noticed that the, you know, newbies, being newbies, they weren't really all into the money. My characters might die. I need to get invested in this. They were more interested in goofing off in a bit. So I slowly, over the next couple of sessions, started switching the flavor of the entire campaign from gritty horror to more and a horror comedy.
Interesting.
Yep.
So that managed to kind of fit that in pretty well, it seems.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they've actually had more fun since, you know, it actually plays into how they were kind of playing their characters.
That makes me think of the meme I saw one time where the campaign I was hoping for, it's just like the Starks from Game of Thrones. The campaign I ended up with, so it's like the Cats of Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
And I think that's pretty common. But so in this example, they talk about, you know, the world in general, not necessarily the tone of the adventure, right? So in this example, they talk about Dark Souls, you know, a hopeless and bleak gothic world can be that way and still have some fun on the side, but the world has this kind of set tone. So having something that deviates from that is a good change to change it up. So don't be afraid to do that. They also talk about, you know, how there's a difference between something like Dark Souls and Dragon Quest or something, Tales of Symphonia. All those settings, they're brighter, they're lighter, they're less, they don't take themselves as serious as like Dark Souls or is it Sekiro?
Yes, Sekiro.
So that's something that you should establish when designing your world right away. Once again, as Garwin said, don't necessarily lock yourself into it. Being able to deviate is going to be a benefit, but make sure that tone is there.
And like how there's often different tones, even within like, say, sci-fi or steampunk or, even though it's not mentioned here, magic punk.
Like a good example for like a world's flavor shifting a little. It's like if you, like, let's say you have like a grim and a dark world, you know, the entire world is basically nothing but darkness because the sun's blocked out or something. A way you could like switch and you slowly transfer that into a more almost lighthearted, but not completely, to go with what your players kind of wish. Is, for example, you can have the clouds occasionally part a little, like go from darkness to like maybe dim light. And instead of having the vampire aristocracy be always tyrants, they can be more like, well, we live forever and we're vampires. Why would we need taxes? You just live as you wish. I just want your blood diamond now and again, you know, donate here and there.
I like the idea of having like a donate station. You don't want us to kill you? Pile in and donate. You can walk out and come back in a month.
We won't even take your money.
First question. What was the last meal you ate?
Oh, this guy's eating pig. Jimmy, this is your flavor.
Italian, come back tomorrow. We don't want garlic.
Hey, Donnie, you like pineapples, right? This guy eats lots of fruit.
Yeah.
All right, so anyway, so establishing world flavor, while we really went off the edge there. So managing geography is the third point here. And this is something that I failed at early on. In order to make a world feel real, you have to kind of sit around and set up, okay, where is everything going to be at, and does it make sense? Especially when it comes to travel routes and visual representations that the in-world characters can use, you know? Mm-hmm. When it comes to traveling in, like, a fantasy setting, the merchants are rarely going to remember the names of all the different things that they can see, but they can point out the dragon spine mountain point or something, or the swamp of sorrows, you know, that you you drive 3 days from the swamp of sorrows. So coming up with a nice grounded geography is important. You don't want a tundra right next to a desert, typically. Things like that, just not only do they not make sense, and though there are exceptions, magic is a thing, right?
Oh yeah.
But you want your
floating mountains.
Yes, and water that falls the wrong direction. I'm a fan of that.
Yeah.
And so when you're managing your topography, there are some things that you want to make sure is consistent. Water runs downhill, you know?
Yeah.
So having a river that runs up a mountain, there should be a reason if that's you're going to do that. There's a reason why. Gravity's broken something.
If you're going to break the laws of physics, make it an exception that has a reason in universe. So that the players can find it and be invested instead of just, you know, if you break the laws of physics just willy nilly and have no reason for it, then every time that player sees something strange, they'll go, it's just one of those, and won't go investigate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really nice point you touched on. Because it's different, it gives them a reason to want to go and learn about it and uncover the lore. So mountains and islands don't float. I wonder why they're floating over there. Let's go look. Is going to be more interesting than if every mountain floats, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's not the best analogy, but...
Like, I remember when a friend of mine who runs a D&D session here also, every now and again, he made a map for a world. It was a really silly world. It had a lot of shenanigans and whatnot, but the map was, you know, it was pretty good. There was one section of the map that caught my interest immediately. Off the side and over the ocean a bit, there were just floating mountains there. I looked at that, looked at the rest of the map. North ice, there's a volcano there, okay. A bit of lava. There's desert, there's tundra, there's kind of foresty thing, okay. Kind of makes sense. I looked at the mountains, looked at there. That stands out. I want to go there. We never did, but to this day, I haven't forgotten about them.
I love that.
You know that island there floating in the air? It has a waterfall coming off it. Where's the water come from? Wouldn't it run out and stop being a waterfall eventually?
Ooh, Darth Yuyo, he says, this is really cool. You make them interesting so the players are smart enough to investigate rather than spend an hour breaking down why you randomly said a toad had yellow markings. I love it. Just when it comes to geography, just make sure it has a semblance of logic. And when you do make exceptions, make sure there's a reason for the exception.
Yeah. Now, a good tip to help get your players invested is to just make a map, and even if you cannot make a proper map, just go into Paint, make a horrible map, and just outline the big things and go, this is here, this is there, and then just show it to the players. They don't even have to keep it. Just show it to them. This is the world, and if you don't want them to look at the horrible drawings more, take it away. They got a glimpse. Now you can do the rest by just describing it, so they know the outline.
Now I remember a post one time that said, one time in my campaign, I had the players travel back 200 years into the past, and at one point I described a giant mountain off in the distance. But then the player's like, wait a second, that mountain wasn't there before. What happened to it? And now I have to figure out what happened to this mountain
between these 200 years. Disappeared. David Copperfield's visiting. All right, so we got to move on. So number four, don't show your full hand. I suck at this.
I do too. I get too excited.
Why are you laughing, Ian?
Just the way you said it.
Yeah, don't show your full hand. So while it is important for the DM to kind of share maybe a map or something of the known world, it doesn't mean that you can't have some surprises and secrets in store for the players. Yeah. When we talked about hex crawls, that was one of my favorite parts of hex crawls is, okay, here's three main points that everyone knows about. Who the hell knows what's in all these other areas? Mm-hmm. And yeah. That part of that discovery is not only fun for the player, but also can be fun for the DM, especially if you're letting them in on the world building process.
Yeah. I'm doing something like this in Grim Hollow. Like, I looked at the Grim Hollow map, and I always thought it was either way too small, or there were way too few settlements.
Okay.
Because, like, when you look at the kingdom, the kingdom
is all covered in it's a technical term.
Yeah. Okay. A kingdom that's covered in darkness, there's like 9 settlements in there. I look at that and I just think, no, that's too little. So I changed it and basically had the things that are marked, those are just cities and towns. Those are important places. Between there are villages and maybe smaller towns that no one cares to mark on a map.
Right.
That they can discover along the way.
And Andrew actually has a good point on this, and I think we've talked about this during the Hex Crawl episode, where giving the maps with mistakes so the player characters can actually fix and correct them, and then maybe even resell a correct map back to other people. So
that's really good.
Just make sure it's okay to keep secrets. And having false information is another really great way to do that.
You know,
describing how the monsters live to the big giant minotaur live in the mountain, and you know, people don't go up there because of the big bad minotaur, and turns out it's not a big bad minotaur, it's some giants or some goliaths who wear like Viking like helmets and make them look like minotaurs, so everyone just leaves them alone.
Ceremonial.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot you can do with that.
It says on this map there's a village right here. Wait. Well, yeah, and we went there, and there was no village there. Huh, that's weird. I mean, there's a giant smoking crater there, but there's no village there.
There's not one now.
Like, another way you could do it is with a map that barely shows anything. Like, it's a map that only shows, like, major cities and things that are, like, 50 miles wide or more, like a 50-mile forest, a 50-mile desert. Sure, there might be forests all over the place, but the map isn't going to give out shit enough to actually mark them down.
For sure. So, and what's interesting is, if Wheel of Time has taught me anything, it's that the people, half the time, don't actually know what's beyond their little areas. And that's something I think that we assume in some cases with adventurers. Oh, an adventurer would know this. Well, where did they learn that? Well, the library in your small village has got 6 books. So, oh, a traveling peddler. Well, now it could be a mistake. It could be an error. It could be wrong completely. Yeah. So...
I mean, your average medieval peasant didn't really leave a 5-mile radius for the most part. So.
Right, for their entire life, too. So.
And another thing people forget, maps are military assets.
Yep.
You never get detailed maps, because that is a military liability. Like, if you're in one kingdom, you get a map of the world, it ain't gonna show shit of other kingdoms. And barely anything of its own, especially if you manage to get it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because how did you get a detailed map? Did you steal it from the... from the Royal Armory?
Oh, snap.
Although, I did find it interesting you mentioned Wheel of Time, because without going into the TV show, like, we've all heard the phrase, how does your character know what a troll is? And so on and so forth. I'm like, my rebuttal is usually, well, in the Wheel of Time, the main characters grew up in a small, isolated farming village, but they still knew what a Trolloc was.
But they, most of them believed it didn't exist.
But they still knew what it was.
Yeah, then they didn't know the weaknesses.
To be fair, that specific village was always emphasized to be exceptionally isolated.
Yeah. Right.
Though that rule still applies.
Yes. All right. So we're going to move on because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
So provide wildlife. This is the single best tool for a game master or dungeon master to share the details of the world and how the area is diverse. Going back to point one, how it is diverse. Yeah. You know, when was the last time in your campaign you randomly described a black squirrel climbing up a tree? Black? Aren't they usually red? Well, here they're black. Well, why is that? You know, who knows? But
I actually need to do more of that.
I remember one time I was deer hunting, like, there's a red squirrel, there's a gray squirrel, there's a black squirrel.
Right. I've never been done anything like that because hunting is boring for me. But
that's why I like it. There's nothing going like on.
So anyway, so when it comes to like the fauna and the not just the creatures themselves, but also like the plants and stuff too. You know, if you've got somebody that's got a poisoner's kit or has a herbalism kit, maybe they or just skilled in nature notice these different types of flowers. You know. Maybe dandelions.
And also, like, you don't need to be proficient in anything related to nature. You could be a random city man that never stepped outside to notice that the purple flowers are weird.
And that's a great point, because if you're used to being in an area where everything is yellow and red, and all of a sudden and now it's purple and blue, that's going to be noticeable, and it makes your world feel diverse. The same thing goes for, like, mountains. Mountains can be made of different types of rocks. Yep. So maybe usually it's limestone, but now it's sandstone, you know, and they notice it's different. Is it going to function have any functional purpose? Probably not, but it makes your world feel more different and alive.
You don't even have to think of a name for it, for any of this stuff yourself. Just say the colors, and if they ask, gibber something and say that's the name.
Ooh, Darth Juyo says something that I've touched on many times and I cannot recommend enough. He briefly talked about, you know, if they're near a forest or something, spotting a Pegasus or something flying in the distance. Little things like that bring your world to life. Whether it's fauna or celestial beings or demons and devils fighting in the sky in the distance. Doesn't have to involve the players, but being aware, well, why is there demons and devils? Well, I heard that there's, you know, Doom Mountain that has a portal to the, you know, Nine Hells somewhere nearby or some shit.
Yeah.
Yep. Dude, I just walked to the countryside on my way over and saw a massive red giant fight a gray giant. Oh, those two again.
They're back at it again. Oh, that's funny. Andrew actually has a really good point here. If you don't know how to make your own time, grab a board game pieces and assign village and cities and natures and features and whatever the various game pieces, scatter them across the randomly. I love that. Yeah. The next thing you want to do is you want to develop, point six, is develop a history. Honestly, this is more difficult than it sounds.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
But you can make a few things consistent by answering a few of your own questions, such as what type of kingdom is in here, right? What type of what is the standard, you know, trade? Is it, does this area deal with, you know, tobacco, or do they deal in wheat, or are they all leather workers? And when you start answering simple questions like that, it automatically starts to spew diarrhea of the mouth of all the different things that are then going to be tied to it.
Or even just a random name drop of something can invoke, like some imagery. Oh yeah, I remember years ago during the Steel Wars. Wait, what?
What the hell's a Steel War? And then you can go off from there.
Yeah.
Like,
there's one thing that Dungeon Masters sometimes run into, though. When they make it, develop a history of the world, they make details so much in the past that no one today has a reason to properly know, that they end up with so much stuff that they can't find anything in it. Which is why I often recommend, instead of developing the entire history, develop things that the people would know and things that are likely to come up or random facts that you might want to bring up.
Like, when I read this one, what came to mind was, I remember years ago I read a cracked article of fan theories that were better than the original source material. And one of them was, what fans came up with was what the Clone Wars were, and mind you, this was when we only had the original trilogy.
Uh-huh.
It's like, okay, here's what we knew about the Clone Wars. It was a war, fought with clones. That's all we do. But it sounded pretty awesome.
Yeah, so you can brainstorm ideas.
Right, and the popular fan theory was, like we all knew like that Jedi were awesome warriors. It's like, hey, you might as well clone the awesome guys, and and people for the longest time thought his name was Obi-Wan Kenobi, which sounds like a serial number. So, like, maybe Ben Kenobi was actually a clone, and Obi-Wan was a serial number, and Kenobi was a template he was based off of.
Oh, shit. Oh. That is way cooler than the actual stuff.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, I will admit, I was a bit disappointed in the Clone Wars because it only lasted 3 years.
Yeah.
But the Clone Wars TV show was awesome.
So, we do have a good question from Darth. Before I get into that, I think a recent history is great. Final Fantasy XIV did this really good with the breaking of the world at the start of the game. It's very recent, in like 10 years, so that's a good way to do it.
Yep.
Darth says, okay, I do have a question on making things feel real. Do you have or use moving battles in the narrative? Like, maybe they talk about the king, but make him angry, and now they have to fight their way out. So,
and it starts in the throne room or meeting room and moves to the halls, then the walls, or the courtyard opening the door.
Yeah. That would be a fantastic way to make a battle feel real, because no battle stands still.
No.
But those those can be difficult to pull off in some cases.
Yeah.
I think for
when it comes to those, I think a preference would be to make it like not an actual down and dusty D&D map or even a Theater of the Mind map, and have actual fighting mechanics, and make it more a skill challenge to try and escape.
Ooh, I like that. I like that. Maybe, or you could even go a hybrid of the two, where you have battle combat, and then there's a skill challenge to get to the next flight up or down, and then it leads to another combat, and another set of skill challenges is a good way to do that.
Okay, I tried to escape by cutting the rope, jump the chandelier, and carry me up. Yeah. Okay, you're the one. What's that mean? The chandelier falls on you instead. Because you cut the wrong rope.
Right rope. All right, so number seven tip is subvert expected tropes. I'm a big fan of this because this helps me as a DM to break up the more negative sides of metagaming. But subverting tropes like pulling from things people have seen a bunch of. Lord of the Rings. Avoid stuff that happens in that because everyone's already familiar with it, for instance.
I get mixed feelings on this one because I see this one more of a balancing act. Because, I get the idea of avoid the tropes, keep things interesting. But at the same time, we kind of like the tropes, so...
Okay.
Yeah, like, they became tropes for a reason.
Yeah.
Right, and that's true, and we've talked about that before, but this gives us a really good example of why I think it's a good way to do it. So
I would say change just enough to keep things interesting, but...
That's why I think you'll like this one. So in the example, it says, you know, orcs, for example, the orcs of one's world could still be war-hungry and violent, but rather than savage brutes, they're calculating tacticians. That, to me, I know is tickling Garwin's dice right now. But that's a really great way to subvert the brutish trope that they are, but still keep them as power-hungry, warlords. So
yeah. Like, I did something similar in a recent campaign of mine. Like, a town was being besieged by orcs. And the orcs had mammoths with trebuchets on them and were using battle strategy in the field, and my players were confused as all hell about what the fuck was going on.
Sounds awesome. I love that. Yeah. So number eight is play to the party's interest. No matter what RPG you're playing, you need to be doing this.
Yeah.
That in my opinion, this is Justin's opinion, and it sounds like these two might agree, that part of the game is engaging the players, and the best way to do that is to pull stuff from what they've written and from their characters and include it.
Yep.
A really good example of this is on the rogue, the default printed rogue, the pre-generated one. It has a little story about how the red brands, and something with your family member or something. So that gives the DM, I can go take these red bands since they're part of their backstory, and now I've kidnapped his aunt or something because this person used to be in the red brands. Those are the things that interest people. Yeah. So you want to keep those in your world.
And kind of the same vein, I think it's good to make sure that your players always have something to do to keep them engaged.
Yeah.
Like, I had a DM who one time complained about how, well, it's not my job to keep you guys interested. You have to find stuff to do. And I'm sitting going, we're playing a Star Trek RPG. The mission was a biological science mission on the planet, and I'm the ship pilot. What am I gonna do?
And it goes even farther than that too. So one of the examples that they give that I really, really like is they talk about if you've got a party full of people who like lore and role playing the diplomacy aspect of the game, they're going to be significantly less likely to be interested in becoming, top tier gladiators. So why don't force them don't set a setting where they're to become the top tier gladiator. That's probably not something they're interested in, but they'll still probably play with you because they love D&T, but
So there is something I will say about this. Be careful not to make every single thing just the stuff you know they're interested in.
Yeah, that's true. Else. You do got to add some variety. I agree.
Like, occasionally, on purpose, make something your players don't like, and see if they go for it or not.
Ah, so you're saying maybe if you deliver it, even though you think they might not like it, that they might? Kind of a trying,
dipping
your toes
in it? Even if they don't like it, yes, and even if they don't like it, it will still then make the stuff they do like look better.
Yeah.
That's true. I like that. So,
but you gotta be careful not to do too much.
Yeah,
of that.
You don't want to have everyone all. How was your game? Ah, it sucked.
Nah, but there'll be a long rant if I go into that. Anyway.
Awesome. I appreciate that. I wish I had that sort of willpower. So number 9 is prepare for your party to go anywhere. This is something So when I played 4th edition and 3rd edition and all that stuff, I always wrote these really complex stories and didn't realize I was funneling my players towards them because I put all this effort into them.
Yeah.
You can put all the time and effort you want into planning, but as soon as you take away their choice, you're actually inhibiting them unless they are okay with being on a railroad. And some people are, and that's okay.
Yep.
A good way to do that, even if you do, like let's say you're running a module. Many people complain that when you're running a module, you have to go through these things and you can't really deviate. What I'm doing right now with my campaign is a pretty good example of you can't properly deviate. Like, for example, I'm running on a Horde of the Dragon Queen, and we're currently in the travel section, and we're in near the end of it, where they're supposed to get to the marsh. But my players instead got distracted by the siege of a town by a bunch of orcs and an undead horde that came, and they went, "What the fuck is that?" Went right past that, allowed the caravan with the cultists to get past them because they knew they could get to the town first before them.
Right.
And went into this dungeon that we've been spending the last 3 or 4 sessions in.
Wow. Yeah. That's
trying to figure out where these undead are coming from, and eventually they'll come out and go after the cultists again.
And that's also the benefit of being prepared for your party to go anywhere, because that also extends to you what they're interested in. And that to me is one of the hands down the important aspects. And because I used to be the other person, be like, "Oh, you bastards, you're going the wrong direction. Yep. There's nothing over there. Well, why isn't there anything over there, Justin?
An element in the game that I ran too, I asked because when I ran Princess of the Apocalypse, the problem was it was meant to be very sandboxy, but the problem was, okay, it's so sandboxy. How do I get the players to even go anywhere?
Yeah.
And the players would say, "You know what? If it keeps the game moving, I don't mind a light railroad."
And that's a really great segue into Darth's comment here. Linear storytelling is okay. A railroad where you basically take away all agency is not.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And that's a very subtle difference, but often gets masked kind of together.
Yep.
So the last tip on this list is allow events to unfold with or without characters. In my opinion, in Justin's opinion, this is the single best world building tip. Because in order for the world to feel real, it has to unfold. Things have to be going on regardless of what the characters are doing.
Yeah. Like it's the effect of the just normal RPG. Like let's say Skyrim, for example. Like people play Skyrim still to this day. But you've constantly see people complain about, like, you become leader of every single guild in Skyrim and no one reacts to it at all.
Right.
And you ignore the end quest line all the time for, like, 50 years in-game. Nothing happens.
Yep.
It allows them to just do whatever, and many people quit along the way.
Yeah.
Yep. Like, one example I can see is, let's say the event you see on a job board, settlement under attack, a call to arms was put out, and the players decided not to take the job because they had something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then 2-3 sessions later, you suddenly see refugees come in from the settlement because they didn't protect it.
So that's a really good example. The one event that I did where I really took this to heart was I had set out 3 destructive options for the players. And one of them was there's a lot of trembling and shaking on the ground of the earthquake. Well, the players weren't super interested in that. So they end up taking another hook, and then when they tried to come back to this village, it was gone because the volcano erupted and destroyed everything. And they're like, where'd it go? It's like, remember that trembling? You know, they were through NPCs. Remember that trembling? The mountain blew its top and destroyed everything, and since you didn't investigate it, nobody was there to warn them. Or you could go another far. I didn't think about going this way. Having another adventuring group go to investigate it and then fail for some reason and the place still blow up. But that makes the world real because it's altering over time due to either inaction or failed action on the party's players' part.
Like another thing with the quest board that my players actually did take, but I had it planned what would happen if they didn't. There were three things, but one of them was just about a bandit, so I'm just going to ignore that.
Mm-hmm.
They took two things. One of them was a request for it was for help to help settling a marriage dispute, and the reward was 500 gold.
Jeez.
Which was a lot.
It does sound like a lot.
Yeah. Another was a request to help subjugate a giant on the road. Now, because the giant on the road was on the way, they didn't know what the fuck was the deal with the giant. They went to the marriage dispute first. And they went there, found a brass dragon couple bickering.
Oh.
What the hell?
And
I love
the
it.
The reason they were bickering was because there were a bunch of exiles on the ground and a red dragon wormling had come out.
Oh.
You've been cheating on me.
It was great. And the best part was, wife couldn't say whether she cheated or was forced because of pride.
Oh, I love it. By the way, we do not condone anything described in that.
Which is why I ignored it completely. I just, went with things.
Moving on.
One of the things that would have happened had they, for example, not taken care of the hill giant later, who thought he was invisible but wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Was that
invisible?
Yep.
That's like that Mystery Men scene where he's like, nobody looks at me, I'm invisible. Yeah, okay.
Like, he literally just had a pie on the road and just a club just.
Oh, that's funny. All right. Overall, these are some pretty amazing tips. Obviously, we have our own thoughts on some of them, but it's a really great article. It's well done. These are things that can totally take you from a new level, a new DM to a masterful storyteller, because when the world evolves and is interesting and intriguing and the player characters want to investigate and poke around, ask questions, that's when you've really succeeded at telling not just a great story, but building a living, breathing world.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that'll do it for our main topic. Before we move on to our Unearthed Tips and Tricks, we have... to take a moment to give a huge shout out to our sponsor, Manscaped. Ho, 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 gentlemen. The holidays came early here at Crit Academy thanks to our generous sponsors at Manscaped. Who is the best in the men's below-the-waist grooming champions of the world? Join over 4 million worldwide who trust in Manscaped with this exclusive offer for you, 20% off and free worldwide shipping with code CRIT at manscaped.com.
Jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up! Manscaped has provided us with the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0 so we could share with you how awesome it is. Inside the Performance Package 4.0, you'll find the Signature Lawnmower 4.0. This electric trimmer has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology to reduce cuts on your nuts. I'm pretty sure we all will kind of appreciate that quite a bit. And it's also waterproof, so you can use it in the shower.
The Manscaped Performance Package 4.0 also includes the Crop Preserver and the Crop Reviver, which feel great, by the way. An anti-chafing ball deodorant, moisturizer, and toner to keep your North Pole feeling and smelling fresh. The ladies will love it, or your spouse will love it, or your partner. This hygiene bundle will also come with a pair of Manscaped anti-chafing boxers, which are so comfortable that they'll keep your junk feeling fresh all day. The perfect package to protect your perfect package.
Tis the season to load up on Manscaped products. So get yourself, your dad, that'd be kind of weird, your brother, and friends the gift of smooth dice this holiday season. The Manscaped Performance Package 4.0.
So we've all had our experiences with these. Brandon's got an amazing unboxing that's going to drop at some point. You're going to love it. But you have a tale to tell in regards to your experience with this.
Do I?
Well, that's okay, because I do.
Okay.
So I always struggle with the different, you know, I don't like to lose my dice, so to speak. So I've experienced, you know, with all the different tools. And when I picked up the lawnmower, I was literally blown away. Okay, probably poor choice of words.
You think?
But I was really surprised at how clean and cut, nice and cut it was. I was super impressed with the fact that I didn't nick myself at all, which is very all too common.
Yep.
I end up bloodied.
Well, I'll admit, as a single guy, this is a topic that I really thought about in a while. And I'll admit, I don't like the idea of like putting a razor blade anywhere near my family jewels.
Yeah, I want to keep those dice nice and clean.
Right, but a pair of clippers, which is kind of what this is, it's definitely a huge step up in that regard. And you know, sweat as much, if you will.
Yeah. Oh, and I also really like it. The one we got came with the weed whacker, which was really great for like this area. Like normally I get little nicks and stuff when I'm trying to trim this bastard. And it was nice and smooth and I had no issues. So anyways, roll a nat 20 this holiday gift giving season and get 20% off and free shipping with code CRIT at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with your free shipping at manscaped.com. Use code CRIT. Clean up your dice and satchel and make Santa proud this year.
And have yourself a smooth bag of holding.
Yes, yes.
And now, what you've all been waiting for. Our Unearthed Tips and Tricks segment, where we bring you new and reusable material for both players and DMs.
First, to kick this off, we have our character Gazept, Thralden Blackhammer, who's a male dwarf. A stout and lanky dwarf with an angular face and bulky smithing arms. He wears simple chainmail with a black tunic with silver stripes, complete with a hood. His head is shaved clean and his beard is two massive black braids down to his knees.
Then we have personality. He is a serious man, but has no problem using sarcasm and insults to verbally assault those who mistreat others, despite his formidable appearance. He prefers to end the disagreement with a toss of the dice or with a contest, a challenge of wits or might. He cares not. He believes he will win both in any case.
Born to a family of adventurers, he is always traveling once he is old enough to walk. His mother filled his nights with stories of swords, magic, and monsters. While his parents have since retired and returned to the dwarven homeland, his urge to seek his own adventure drives him to travel the world and create his own stories to pass to his children. If he just so happens to put a miscreant in their place while doing so, then his life is joyful.
He wants to write a book about the wonders of the world. His experiences with as many people and cultures as he can experience. Something that will stay with the world long after his passing. It always seems the world is always at war. He wants to show the good side of the world. Yes, even the monsters. Each creature has a gift to give this world. Thralden will ensure that everyone has an opportunity to experience it through him.
Ooh, what do you guys think?
World-weary traveler who writes down his experiences that he can hope to pass on to others. That was good.
Yeah, and definitely sounds like an awesome character. I mean, could you imagine, like, you see this dwarf, you expect him to be like a fighterish character, be a brute. Then he throws a quip your way that you expect from the bard.
That would be definitely something to be a surprise. And I think that's we're going. Breaking those tropes, man. I like this as a character for an NPC and for a PC. It's some good stuff. Make sure you guys check it out. And yes, I absolutely had a blast with that ad. It was a lot of fun. I do enjoy
even I could tell
playing with my dice.
I'm good at reading characters.
All right, that'll do it for our character concept, Thralden Blackhammer. Our monster variant is the Goblin Hexer. So, in order to build this bad boy, you're going to start with a stat block for the Lamia. The features it's going to lose is its spell list, claws, and you're going to swap its strength and dex scores, and it's going to lose its intoxicating touch. The new spell list will include Thaumaturgy for an at-will, and three a day each, Absorb Elements and Mirror Image, and once a day, Eye Bite. we're going to give it a new feature. Now, if you don't know, this new feature is called Channel. It's very much based on the template of Breath Weapon, where the channel is recharge 5 to 6. The goblin uses one of the following channel features. A creature can only be under the effects of one of these cursed channels at a time. A curse placed on a target already under the effects of the curse has no effect. A remove curse spell does end this effect. So one of the three is the Affliction Hex. The goblin bestows a curse upon a creature within 60 feet. The goblin chooses one ability score. The target must succeed on a DC 14 wisdom save or become cursed. While cursed, the target has disadvantage on ability checks and saving throws made with that ability score. Ouch. its other channel hex is Ebon Hex, which the target must succeed a wisdom saving throw or become cursed. And while cursed, the target takes an extra 1d6 necrotic damage whenever it is hit by an attack.
That
hurts too. And Stupor Hex. Whenever, while cursed, the target must make another wisdom saving throw at the start of each of its turn. If it fails, it wastes its action that turn doing nothing. Ouch.
Oof. That will definitely hurt.
Yeah.
I will say, though, I do love the idea of taking the Dragon's Breath Weapon mechanic and making another ability for it.
Well, thank you. I'm quite proud of rehashing a mechanic somebody else already designed. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
I very often rehash mechanics, but this is actually something I didn't think to do.
Yeah, and it was one of those things that... So, for those that don't know, Wizards of the Coast is rechanging the stat blocks, right? Mm. And one of the things that they did is they moved the spellcasting list down to the actions and are putting, like, the core actions instead of spells on the bar, which sucks for counterspellers, by the way, but...
Yeah, that was one complaint. That
yeah,
was
that's a big one. but they do still have the spell counting, but the goal is to get the DM to not have to look at the spell list to play the character as intended. And so for this, the rechanneling or the channeling, which I'm calling it, which is basically a variant on the dragon breath weapon, is a really great way to do that, because now you can play this character without having 20 different spells on your list to try to go through. You can just use them as is. What is so funny?
Well, you said channeling. Are we going to have a dragon reborn?
I see what you did there. Welcome, William. I'm glad you found the stream. So what do you guys think about this? I mean, it's obviously designed to curse the players.
Yeah.
I definitely like the curse ability because it's an ongoing effect that screws over people, and you have three excellent ways to do it.
Yeah.
And it reminds me quite a bit of the witch from Pathfinder who had hex abilities.
Yep.
So. And also especially love it because DMs often focus too much on damage.
Yes. Yes.
They don't appreciate how debilitating this stuff can be.
And I just posted something about all monsters, in my opinion, should have reactions. And everyone says, well, then you're going to do more damage. And in my post, I specifically said reactions that don't do damage would be best, that could be thematic, like a fear that targets or increasing AC with parry is a common one. And I think that this kind of falls in line with that being a debilitating ability instead of just extra damage, which means you can put them in the back. The fun thing is they can make some attacks with absorb elements and mirror images. They can absorb damage, so they're very versatile, but their goal is to punish the players indirectly, which is what I was going for.
Should have given those zombie drugs an aura with a debilitating effect.
Yes. All right. So, our wonderful guest, Garwin, would you like to tell us about our encounter of the podcast?
The hot-headed. Sure. Eveth Ferey, a female half-elf mage, is seeking the aid of adventurers. She has been delving into complex lore and history to locate a powerful artifact known simply as the Spark. Ooh, an amulet of planes. The spark is said to allow any who wield it to shift between the different planes of the multiverse. Eveth wants to explore the multiverse and record the different worlds. This tool will allow her to do just that. She, unfortunately, ran into a small snag. She believes she has located the item in a lost temple hidden in the mountains. Well, she has no problem deciphering the complex runes and avoiding the traps. she ran into an unexpected challenge. The vault room is barred by magic and defended by two flame skull guardians, known as Ten and Peller.
I forgot that's what I named them.
Wow.
Yep. A character who succeeds in a DC 18 intelligence arcana check knows that flame skulls regenerate shortly after being destroyed. She is unable to defeat them both in combat and has been unsuccessful at reasoning with them. She needs allies to take down the tiny terrors. The battle area is littered with scorch marks and rubble. Worst of all, most of the floor has holes and looks to give away at any second. Since the flame skulls fly, it is only a challenge for the party. Below the temple floor is a deep chasm 200 feet deep. Explosions slowly batter away the floor during the fight. A character who succeeds in a DC 19 intelligence arcana check or religion check knows that the only way to stop the regeneration process is sprinkling its remains with holy water or a dispel magic or even a remove curse spell.
Yeah. Flame skull is one of my favorite creatures in this game.
What do you guys think about this?
Oh, I love it.
Yep.
I had a bubble in my throat. I also love that on a name, hot-headed.
Yeah, I'm a bit.
You can make it a pun and a description. You can make the flame skulls hot-headed.
Yes, I love it.
And I also love the fact that it offers a tiny sliver of possibility of reasoning with them.
Yes, they are intelligent creatures, so that's definitely one of the big things. Dulcinea brings up a really great point that says, please tell me they rip apart any attempts to for the casters or the enemies to cast spells. One thing that they can do that's really interesting. Not only do they have blur, which makes it harder to hit them, they have the shield spell, magic missile. There's so much threat that comes from these little bastards that will just terrorize your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. And also her additional comments, they can literally just go, that's not magic, and I saw your lips move!
And they also have a solid amount of resistances and immunities.
Yes, so it really...
And I kind of felt bad one time where a player was hit a bunch of flame skulls with a cone of cold, and I forgot they were immune to cold.
Because even though they're flame, they're immune to cold, fire, and poison. So they're terrifying little bastards.
Enough, makes a bit of sense, considering what are you going to do with something that's on fire? are you going to freeze the fire? Why is it easier to freeze something that's on fire than something that isn't?
Well, in
did you just try to paralyze me? I'm a skull! I have no body to paralyze!
Well, they also can make flaming spheres, which allow you can move around the battlefield by they just laugh and taunt the player characters, which is a lot of fun. So they're too hot to feel cold. That's funny. Yeah. Overall, it's a pretty simple, straightforward adventure. Obviously, I've been running the Plane Shifter game online for everyone, and so the Spark and all the Planeswalker stuff's there because that's what I've been studying and everything. So overall,
you could even make them a bit special. Make them specific creatures that are a bit above normal flame skulls. They're exact same stats, except they have the innate ability to cast counterspell twice a day. Both of them separately.
Ouch.
So every time they counter a spell, they always go, that's not magic, or I saw your lips move.
I like that. I like that.
I saw the pigeon inside your sleeve.
Fake! Overall, it's a pretty fun one. I think the big challenge comes from the fact that as the battle goes on, the floor kind of disintegrates, and that makes for challenges in and of its own self. So, all right.
Definitely a good idea to establish for yourself what round the floor finally gives out.
Yes. Me, I'm a fan if a fire hits and then that chunk goes out, you get a dex save to grab onto a lip.
Oh, yeah.
Alcina says, chef's kiss. Perfection. All right, that'll do it for our encounter, hot-headed. Our magic item of the show is the Fae Wild Displacer Key Rune.
It is a wondrous item that is rare and requires attunement. Key runes are ceremonial stylized keys about a handspan long, and made from carved stone. Isn't it is also not a literal key. It's similar to a badge or medal. When you use an action to speak the item's command word and place a key rune on the ground in an unoccupied space, it transforms into a creature, and there isn't enough space, doesn't transform. The creature is friendly to you, your companions, and other members of your party, unless they're hostile to you. It understands your language and obeys your spoken commands, and if you issue no commands, it automatically takes the dodge action to avoid danger. The creature exists for a duration specific to each key rune, and at the end of the duration, the creature reverts back into its key rune form, and it reverts early if it jumps to 0 hit points, or if you use an action to speak the command word again. And when it reverts to its key rune form, it can't transform again until 36 hours have passed. And in this case, carved into an ancient Feywild tree with purple granite elements to resemble a cat with tentacles, this key rune can become a displacer beast for up to 8 hours. In addition to fighting on your behalf, this displacer beast cheerfully rubs against you, purring. Anyone who talks with a transformed key rune or examines it closely can easily recognize it as an artificial creature.
Huh. What do you guys think?
I love this.
I'll definitely take having a pet displacer beast at my command.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's so rare to find a friendly displacer beast. Now, this is a non-lore-breaking way to do it.
You're welcome, everybody. In all openness, I did style this after the badges in the Ravnica book.
Yeah.
I forget what they're called, but...
And I know there's some figurines that do similar
yep,
things,
too. Yep, there are figurines that do some similar stuff, too. There's a Panther one. I almost used that as a template, but this was so much cooler. Anyways, this is one of the things that I feel like works really well as a reward for achieving a certain level of reputation with a group, which is how the item is used in the Ravnica book. When you choose a guild or a faction and you go up in rank, these are some of the things that they give the people at those ranks. This is one of the higher level ones.
I could definitely see you gaining one of these. Like, let's say you went into the Feywild and you did a favor for one of the Fey courts.
Okay.
Like, they wouldn't want to, like, give something too significant because, you know, mm-hmm. they're Fey.
Right, right.
They could give Stingy one of bastards. These out as a way to pay back a debt. Because, like, Peys, they cannot stand being in debt.
Yeah.
So they could give one of these and be like, this clears our debt, basically.
Ooh, I like that. I like that a lot. All right, that'll do it for our magic item, the Feywild Displacer Key Rune. If you like this stuff, you can head on over to our blog for the show notes for this episode, and you can copy and paste this and store it in your own little Google file or whatever. The Dungeon Master tip of the episode is... the organization Shadowfang in Syndicate. So here's something new I'm tinkering with. The idea of a Dungeon Master tip giving you something functional for your world to use. So please let me know what you think. Braca Shadowfang, bugbear of some renown, founded the Syndicate nearly 30 years ago. Today, she still has an active hand in the Syndicate's affairs, but her age has pushed her son, Murin, to take command. The Syndicate dabbles in a variety of criminal enterprises, from gambling, protection rackets, and much more. The Shadowfangs carved their niche in the underworld through a combination of brute force, cash, and access to monstrous allies outside the city who are eager to do business with their contacts. Orc mercenaries seeking service for evil lords, cultists in search of safe secret lair or illegal reagents for their dark rituals, and wanted folk eager to turn the goods and coin looted from their victims into fine goods and services. After all, a few hundred coins stashed in a chest beneath an orc chief's cot are worthless unless he can do something with them. The Shadowfangs found willing allies on both sides of the supply chain. Their monstrous emissaries buy luxury goods and service, costly ales and other liquors, and deliver them to at ludicrous markups. The locals inside the city they deal with are too intimidated to ask for high prices. While the savage kobold goblins and orcs are generally too ignorant to question the exorbitant prices the Shadowfangs exact. When not making merchant sales, running goods between factions, they delve into the seedy underbelly with a nefarious work. A favorite of Bracca's is investigating in short-term loans to those in need, employing criminals for assassinations to the highest bidder, and, of course, the more traditional banditry of traveling competitors. Of course, the Bracca and Murin are skilled at covering their evidence of their side hustles.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a lot.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
I do like it. I definitely appreciate a good fleshed out shadowy organization to build off of.
Oh, yeah. Do I disagree with one part?
What's that?
The part about a few hundred coins stashed under an orc chief's cot having no purpose. They're shiny, okay? They're good to look at.
Fair enough. This is certainly... I've been delving a lot into seedy dives, and you guys will get to... see that where I'm going with that later, upcoming. But this was one of the side effects of that work, and I hope that you guys like it. This is pretty fleshed out, so if you need a CD, you know, thieving crew or whatever, this is, you can take this right off our website. Yeah. Anything you guys have anything to add to that?
I do like the idea that they craft like metals and coin into more expensive pieces of artwork to increase your investments and sell them off for high prices. Absolutely.
And when I was thinking of that, it was more or less they're hiding the evidence of what they stole.
Right.
The recrafting, it was just a bonus.
Way to do that. Like if you steal 50,000 silver coins, who's gonna look for like 25,000 statues?
Right. That was just one of those, what would I do if I had this and I couldn't just spend 50,000 of whatever, right? All right, that'll do it for our Dungeon Master Kit, the organization, the Shadowfang Syndicate. Yes, I totally stole the name Shadowfang right from the dungeon in World of Warcraft because I thought it was awesome as hell.
I don't think anyone would really care.
All right. Moving on to our player tip of the podcast. Don't be a dick.
Almost.
Would you like, Garwin, would you like to tell us about our player tip of the podcast, the Juggernaut Cleric?
I actually rather like this idea. This build is really straightforward. Choose the Warforged race from Eberron Rising from the last war. It gives you a +1 integrated protection. Then pick up Chainmail Armor, base 16 AC, and Shield for an extra +2. Now we have a total of 19 AC, and that's without a class. The class that makes the build work the best is Cleric of the Forge from Xanathar's Guide. It allows the cleric to bless a piece of armor, giving it a +1 extra AC. Then taking the spell Shield of Faith will give you more +2 AC. There's some spelling errors in there.
Suddenly,
your 22 AC first level character is wading into hordes of goblins who only have a 10% chance to hit you. This build is considered legal and shouldn't have too many issues at the table, unless you're the DM.
Yeah, I actually ran this build only with a dwarf, and it was kind of hilarious in the very first fight to go, well, have the DM go, does a 20 hit you? Expecting it to be yes, I'm like, no. Wait, what?
Yeah.
So there, I've done tips about the fact that armor class isn't the end all be all, but I felt like this needed some love.
Yep.
Because AC, doesn't help you when you get kicked off a mountaintop. But meantime, against hordes of enemies, it absolutely does. And the cleric is best for this because they've got so many spells that let them, attack enemies all around them. So it just seems like a juggernaut cleric is exactly what the game called for.
Yeah.
Probably the best part about this is that, you only start with chainmail, yes, but it's your starting equipment. You're gonna increase that eventually, from a 16 plus all of that to an 18 plus all of that.
Yep.
Because a forged cleric has proficiency with heavy armor.
Yes, it does.
Yep. probably the best part about, on top of all that, you're a cleric. You don't have to be a melee fighter.
No. Yeah, and the Forge Domain cleric can make his own plate mail if he wants to, dang it.
Absolutely, which is awesome.
Yeah, you don't even have to spend 1,500.
This is certainly a fun concept. You can really have a lot of fun when it comes to clerics just because of the versatility. But giving one such a high AC as the tank and taking up utility abilities to help your allies, you literally can make it so that you are the center of attention. You are drawn, which means the wizard, the sorcerer, the warlock, all the squishies don't got to worry about it. Yeah. And it's much easier for a rogue to get sneak attack when you're literally surrounded by the enemy. They just run up behind him and stab him in the ass. So,
I will also admit, it's a great flavor opportunity. Like, you're a warforged.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, using blessing one or two on a better your armor, but you can flavor that as you're tweaking with your now integrated protection. Because remember, the armor isn't, you don't put the armor on. You integrate it into yourself as a warforged. It becomes your new body.
Nice. I love it. This is one of my favorite races for a lot of reasons, but the flavor that comes out of it is just fantastic. All right, that'll do it for our player tip of the podcast. Don't be a dick.
Yeah, dick.
I think that'll do it for our show today. Before we close out, we do have a gift to give away, as with every week. This week's RPG Fat Loot giveaway is the Reanimator, a Necromancer Artificer specialization. Choose one of two reanimated assistants and upgrade them with biological samples harvested from fallen foes, and master the forces of life and death as an artificer. So much fun, so cool. Our winner today is iServoxy. And if you didn't win, no problem. Head on over to CritAcademy.com and subscribe to our newsletter for a chance to win. Additionally, if you have not signed up for our newsletter, just signing up gives you a free copy of our best-selling challenge accepted skill challenge book. Please pick it up. Please pick it up. Please pick it up. It's awesome. With that, I want to say thank you to our wonderful Emerald patron, Garwin. Thank you for joining us today and filling in for Brandon. If you enjoy the show and you want to support us, you can visit us at CritAcademy.com, follow us on social media, and leave us a review. As I've said before, if you're watching this later, and you do join us, you had me at Necromancer Artificer. If you are watching this, please consider following and watching us on YouTube. We get more exposure from the more viewers are consolidated into one area. So if you enjoy our content, please do that. Interact with us in the chat, all that jazz. So with that, I am your host, Justin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
Thanks for listening. Keep your blade sharp and spells prepared, heroes.